performing tomorrow night. Steve graced us with his beautiful sounds last night. And this is a discussion around the topic subject of collaboration, which has been a theme certainly of this week, as you've seen in many forms and guises. And I thought the format would be, I will start maybe with a few statements and then questions of our honored guests here today. But I did want to say first that they have, of course, as you know, collaborated for many years with each other, but they've also collaborated with poetry and a vast range of other kinds of texts, including Buckminster Fuller, just one example. They've written operas, song cycles. Irene has been a major interpreter of these kinds of texts. Often, if you look at the, as some of the students have in the class that they've been doing all week, looked at the text that Steve prepares, they're, you know, in a very beautiful hand. They're also often retitled and often homages to other artists and musicians and writers and so on. So there's a kind of interesting collaboration with the texts that are chosen, as well as the sense of homage with the music, and then the manifestation of that collaboration with both Steve and Irene performing, and then taking it to, you know, another level through performance, and then through recording, and performance in different ways, often with, you know, solo instrument and voice, and then beyond that with more music, trios, orchestras, and so on. So there's a, you know, a real multi-layered quality to the kinds of collaborations they've done. And I'm, you know, always continually impressed by their, you know, intensity and ferocity and commitment to the work that they do and their ongoing agenda of anti-standard, which is terrific, actually, and refreshing. I don't know anybody else working in these ways. I first met Steve years ago. I was in high school and had the great privilege of meeting him in the company of Thelonious Monk and others. That's another form of collaboration, the sense of apprenticeship, the sense of elders, which is something we honor here. We want people coming who have something to transmit, and there's a kind of transmission taking place through the, you know, the oral and performative, as I've, you know, stressed on many occasions, that the, you know, the wonderful value of what we do here this summer is this orality and one-to-one and apprenticeship, and it's still very much a human universe. Irene was early on in San Francisco and knew a lot of the poets there, the poets associated with the New American Poetry and the particularly the San Francisco Renaissance, including Jack Spicer and that circle. So I was going to ask them both to maybe speak a little bit about their early lives, training, what drew them to their passionate work, and then how they started working together, and then we'll move on and on to the more specific details of that kind of collaboration. Mm-hmm. So, tell us a little bit about your backgrounds and how it all started.
You just said San Francisco, that was before I knew Steve, and that's before I knew I was going to be a singer. I didn't know what I was doing. I was 21. And now, Steve and I, we call that ruminating. That's when you don't know exactly what you're going to do, but you're interested in literature. I had a formation as a classical violin player, but didn't get very far. My teacher said, well, if you can do anything else better, then I would recommend you change. You're never going to be a great violin player. But still, all the music helped me a lot, you know, now, because I had a classical so-called background. And since age 6, I was playing the violin and the piano. And then, you know, I came from a family of disaster. And then so I went on the road. And so I ended up in, met a guy in Naples and ended up in San Francisco. And that was just a time after the beatnik thing was over. I said, well, I always come there when everything is over. And it was dry, and I think Allen Ginsberg was in India, and Gary Snyder was in Japan, and I heard about Joanne Kiger. I heard about Anne, but she wasn't there, and I was it was just I don't know 3-4 months, but I met the right person, which was for me my mentor Jack Spicer, and he was this angry, wonderful poet, severe, and he gave these poetry lessons or teachings, you know, where people came with their poems and were so long, and he just reduced them to 4 lines and explained them why. And I liked that school very much. I think it's a great school. And he really explained people. He had a lot of heart. We were sitting in aquatic park and listened to baseball games, which for me was something completely out because I'm European. But I could see, you know, when you're 21, you just shut up and you can see this is somebody very important that you met and you better take in what he has to tell you, you know. And I was drinking a lot of beer, and so I wasn't drinking, but I followed him from bar to bar. And it was no poetry classes like you all, very lucky to come here, you know. But it was also free, yeah, you know. But so that was very interesting. I can tell you that turned me on, that severeness and of Jack Spicer, and though I didn't possess the language as well as I do today, it was so important, you know, to know who was good. And at that time, the poets were protesting to each other, like they wrote a poem against Ferlinghetti, you know, they say bebop the beep or something like that. And then they went to protest in front of Robin Duncan's house because he wrote a bad poet, nobody else, they don't like. So that was all very, very much alive, you know, to react. It reminded me about the Russian poets. You know, everybody was really into that. It was a poet was a serious affair. So, well, that's what I learned, and I went back to Italy and blah, blah, and I went in. And years later, I met Steve in Rome. I think I was already 27. Yeah. So when I was in San Francisco, I was 21 or something. Okay.
Well, wow. It's true. I met Irene in 1966 in Rome. I had already been playing since 1950. The saxophone and trying to write in the mid-60s, but not succeeding. And I played with a lot of famous people and had a lot of experience. And I was floating around Europe and having a good time. And one day in Rome, somebody introduced me to Irene. And that was the beginning of now. And we've been together since then, really, with certain interruptions, but our collaboration really began that day. And let's see. Well, we went to South America together with my quartet on an ill-fated junket, and we got stuck down in Argentina for almost a year, tangled up in the tango. And then we went to New York in 67, and that's where I started writing for Irene. And my first compositions, really, the very first one was from Lao Tzu, and it was The Way, a song called The Way. There's no need to run outside for better seeing. So I set that for Irene to sing, and then I also set the Buckminster Fuller New Year's card for her. And we took a quintet to Europe and performed those two things.
Yeah. In Hamburg at the television, Hamburg, they were horrified about the Buckminster Fuller piece because it was like a rap piece because it's very long and so goes by very fast. I did it the other day in the class. And, we've got to go fast because our life is so long. So then we were living in Italy and blah, blah.
Then we went to Rome. We were out of work and we went to Rome, back to Rome, and we stayed there for a couple of years working with Musica Electronica Viva and working also with amateurs, doing a lot of research. And
we were playing the so-called free jazz. We were one of the first people to play that music, where we break down the barriers of harmony of everything. It just, the form was like an evening, and we played all kinds of instruments which weren't forcibly the instruments we knew how to play.
And objects too. We were banging on the walls and on garbage cans and playing with cars and street sounds and everything. It was a period where the Living Theater was roaming through Europe, and everything was turned around. The audience was invited in, and the artists were going out, and it was a hell of a moment, the 68, 69, really. It was and we had a movement there which we called Roba. Roba is an Italian word. It means stuff, situation, thing, anything. It's a word that's, you know, so because that described the nature of the music that we were doing then, you could use anything and make sounds with it and mix it up. And we were doing that in art galleries and on the streets and everywhere. And it was a very interesting period. We also had a thing that was very interesting back then. It was called zuppa. You remember zuppa?
Yeah.
Zuppa, the soup in Italian. We had a studio with these guys from Musica Electronica. These were contemporary composers who were very interested in improvisation. And the way Zuppa worked was we had instruments lying around the studio, like a trumpet, a trombone, a piano, some drums, an accordion, and anybody could come in and pay 1,000 lire, which is very little, and they were encouraged to pick up these instruments and play them. And they had never played anything before. So a guy would come in, and there were six of us professional musicians in the studio waiting for them, for the victims, you know? And the people would come in, and they would pick up a trumpet, and they'd go, "Bleh!" And our job was to make music out of that. We had to leap in. It was an emergency. Every sound was an emergency. We had to come in and fix that sound, add something to it right away, and make it into a music. And this was a wonderful exercise, very fraught with peril, but very interesting. It lasted quite a few weeks. We did that until we started to feel like Prometheus, and they were picking our skin apart, really. So it didn't last forever, but it was a very, very fruitful and interesting experience. And it showed that you can conceivably make music out of anything, out of just, you know, with amateurs, with idiots, with anybody at all could pick up anything and just do anything. And
that's not politically correct.
We would come in and repair the damage immediately. And that was very interesting because every sound was an emergency. And, you know, in an emergency, you come up with solutions that you wouldn't come up with ordinarily. So I found myself playing things that I had forgotten completely before. They would just come, a phrase would come out of my childhood or something like that because it was an emergency. So that was a very, very interesting experience. And, well, anyway, in 1970, we moved to Paris because we were tired of working with amateurs. And we wanted to form a group, and I knew that there were a lot of good musicians in Paris, so that we moved to Paris, and sure enough, we found very good musicians there, and we formed a group which lasted over 20 years, really, and we did all kinds of things with that group and made many concerts and shows and dance theater pieces and all kinds of stuff, and I said a lot of things for Irene's voice. Irene is a wonderful singer and was very patient enough to put up with my experiments. And I really didn't know what I was doing, but working with Irene, I found out what not to do.
I think he was very patient with me.
Oh, well. That's very nice. So through the years, we've handled a lot of The theme is collaboration. Well, jazz is a music of collaboration. You can't do jazz by yourself. I mean, you can, but it doesn't go anywhere. It's a music that can travel, that can collaborate. It's a collaborative music where people, you know, even in the old style, I started in traditional jazz, the New Orleans style and the Kansas City style, Chicago style. I was lucky enough to come up in the 50s in New York when all the giants of all the different schools were still active and at the peak of their playing careers. And I was just a kid, 18, 19 years old, playing the soprano saxophone and the clarinet. And I didn't compete with anybody because nobody else played the soprano saxophone. So I didn't threaten anybody else's job, and I was able to infiltrate myself into the jazz world like that. And I was lucky enough to find a great teacher, Cecil Scott, who took me under his wing and showed me the ropes and allowed me to sit in with the different stars that I played with, all these wonderful old-time musicians. And that's how I really learned how to play a little bit. And then I met Cecil Taylor in 1953, and he plucked me out of that music and threw me into the avant-garde maelstrom, into the radical forefront of jazz, really. I didn't even realize it at the time because I liked what he was doing. It didn't seem so weird to me, but everybody else thought it was terrifying. So I stayed with Cecil for 6 years, and I learned a lot from him. He was really like a guru, a guide to me. And speaking about collaboration is, and the idea, you know, I've been very lucky. I've always been able to find somebody stronger than myself and attach myself to them and find and give them something, even if it just was a humor. Like I had a sense of humor, so I made Cecil laugh. And so he kept me around because I made him laugh. And he and I learned all these things from him, what to look for, what to listen for. And he took me to see Merz Cunningham. He turned me on to Stravinsky and Bartok and all the bebop piano. I mean, really, I learned so much from hanging around with Cecil Taylor that it was a miracle. And then I met Gil Evans, and he showed me wonderful things. And he made a role for me in a big band. And then Thelonious Monk, I got with him. And then, you know, and then until the mid-60s when the music became so radical that we couldn't make a dime. So when I got to Europe in 65, I decided to stay for a while because in Europe, I didn't have to work days and I could play. And there were radio programs and other musicians and fans and possibilities of living from the music, which was not the case in New York at that time. And then I was lucky enough to meet Irene. We went down to South America, went back to New York, to Rome, and to Paris. And we've been in Paris for 30 years, over 30 years, and we're about to move back to the States next year. We're going to be in Boston, and I'll be teaching at the New England Conservatory. So this starts a new chapter in our collaboration.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about the first pieces you worked with and decisions around the texts you chose and what, I know you're phenomenal readers. These are some of the best read people I know. In every conversation, there are about, you know, 10 titles one needs to take down. They're, you know, phenomenal readers in all fields. And so what, you know, what, I think of you as very literary people. What was the push there? What were you looking for in text? I know that's simplistic because there's so much range.
Well, all my life I've been interested in song and dance and theater and cinema and painting and literature and poetry for a long time. And I always wanted to find lyrics for jazz that was more interesting than what was currently being done. And I learned all the standards when I was young, but you know, the standards have been done. And some of them have been done to death, really. And there won't be another Billie Holiday along. And you know, the idea of doing standards over and over again, and it's too conventionalized, really. And I didn't want to do what everybody else was doing, and I had the idea, and I was inspired in this a little bit by Duke Ellington, because Duke Ellington was a very literate, and he had some wonderful lyrics that he used, and he wrote some interesting things himself that suggested to me the possibility of putting more literature into the jazz. Also in the 60s, the music became so radical that there was no longer any voice in it. There was no singing and there was no dancing.
No melody.
No melody, there was no harmony, there was just chaos. It was wonderful, it was necessary, it was beautiful, but you couldn't sing it and you couldn't dance it. So we lost our public. Public went away and they went toward rhythm and blues, rock and roll, and all those things because they couldn't dance to what we were doing. So later on, the music got calm again and we started to go into the dance forms, and I started to set all kinds of lyrics for Irene to sing. Now, Irene herself is very literate, and I had to watch what I provided for her. We had to agree on the content. And the Lao Tzu was something I had been thinking about for about 7 or 8 years. I had been wanting to set that, and I couldn't do it. I tried over and over again. But when I met Irene, there was the voice for me, and I was able to conceive the music and fish it out for her. It's like a couturier, you know, you want to make a beautiful dress, but if you don't have a model to try it on, it's just a dress hanging up on a hanger. It doesn't do anything, really. But with Irene, I had a model. I had a muse and a model, and I could work with her and try out different things. So we set a bunch of things from Lao Tzu and the Buckminster Fuller piece. These were the very first choices of texts that we used. And later on, we got into all kinds of poets, scientists, and found poetry. We set postcards, newspaper articles, all kinds of things we set to music, and always at first for her voice, but later on, other singers started to become interested in it, and I also did a lot of workshops with singers where sometimes we had 40 singers singing these songs, really, and that was very interesting, so I've learned a lot in those situations, but always it's the content that interests me, because for one thing, to make music out of a text, you have to live in it, you have to dwell upon it, and you have to repeat it over and over again, and you have to write it down, you have to believe in it, you have to stand behind it, you have to come to terms with it, you have to get to the bottom of it, you have to study the structure, you have to study the sound of the language itself, and you have to really consider how to do that. It's a lot of thought involved, research and thought, and it's been a passionate work, really, and it's still going on, really. By now we have about 250 vocal pieces, a lot of which have never been done, and a lot of which have been done and realized on records and in concerts, and some of it's rare, some of it's medium, some of it's well done, some of it's undone. And I'm still writing new stuff because I'm always shopping for texts, for things that can be set. And there's no shortage, really. There's fine, you know. While I was here, I wrote something for microfinance. I've been, you know, thinking about them, really, and writing a little slogan, a jingle for microfinance. I don't know if I'll ever get it to them, but It's a subject, you know. There's always a theme, something you could get into. And we've done a lot of pieces of scientists, too. We have a Richard Feynman piece, and we have a piece about race, and we have a lot of...
let's do the Feynman piece.
We're going to perform the Richard Feynman. Do you all know who Richard Feynman is? Richard P. Feynman was a genius, a scientist. He's a physicist. He worked on the atomic bomb in Los Alamos, the Manhattan Project, and he was involved in the NASA, the shuttle, and he was he won the Nobel Prize, and he wrote a lot of books. And he was also an amateur drummer, and he loved to play jazz, and he was really into rhythm, and he wrote. Well, if you ever pick up some of his books, there's a book of his that's very interesting. It's called Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman. And he was a great joker, a great prankster, and a very funny man, and very brilliant. And he's got a lot of books out now. And the easy ones I would recommend to you, like Surely You're Joking, Mr. Fireman, and another one. This text comes from another one called What Do You Care What Other People Think?
Yeah, and I found this poem in in the book. It was a little poem.
A lot of my ideas came directly from Irene. That's true.
No, and I learned it. I remember coming back from the vacation because it's about waves in the sea. He's standing on the sea and he's sinking. And so I learned it in the train, and then Steve came and got me in the at the train in Paris, and I knew it almost by heart. So then he set it into music. It's about waves and molecules and things like that.
It's toward the end of his life. He wrote this poem about just standing by the sea and watching the waves and thinking about the origins of and the nature of life. We call it particles. And I never received permission from the publisher to do this, so don't report me.
Yeah, that's another chapter.
Yeah, very often, you know, you got to get permission for all those texts, and that's another story in itself. I've gone, you know, and this particular one, the publishers never answered me.
Yeah.
Collaboration is a struggle, too.
Yeah. Gotta keep it alive.
You don't always agree.
No.
No, not at all. There's a lot of fighting involved.
Thank you. As you say, you could never understand all those words. I just hear the gentleman saying that because they go by fast. So what we usually do, we give people the text. I can read it to you again because that's what he just said. I can never understand a word. Sometimes we have the word atoms or waves or universe, but you can understand the sense. It's like a scientific lecture, right? I sing sometimes English songs in Italy on the piazza. You know, you can't translate everything. It gets heavy, or I have no translation in Italian. But people in Italy have very good ears. So, you know, generally, it's always the same emotions we go to, you know. It's wonder and science, and it's the way, you know, that's why it makes me, that made me really be more alive when I have a public who doesn't understand the word of what I'm saying. You know, it could be as well as Chinese. So, because you can't put your foot on every word, it takes the music away, you know? I have to go on. So, what we do in concerts, often now, we give the texts mm-hmm. to people, so they can take it out. What was that poem exactly about? I didn't hear, you know, especially those long ones.
Yeah, we'll do one more. This one is much simpler, and this comes from a recent article I read in the New York Times, about race.
Well, you can read that first.
Race is a social concept, not a scientific one. We all evolved in the last 100,000 years from the same small number of tribes that migrated out of Africa and colonized the world. And this was said by Dr. J. Craig Venter, Celera Genomics Corporation, Rockville, Maryland.
do you have another physics 10? I don't like to be next to you. No, because you know.
See how it is?
Because the sound is better like this. Rockville, Maryland.
the last friend of a thousand years, from the same small number of lives that migrated out of Africa and colonized the world. And colonized the world. Lost a cheek by a band of red art and obisco,
Dr. Benda hasn't heard it. Did we send this to Dr. Benda, or he doesn't know that we're singing his
own? Well, we sent it to the New York Times.
Yeah.
And to, we did get have, permission for this.
To have permission, yeah.
All right. Maybe you could talk about some of the opera work, the song cycles with Nazrim and some of these productions that involved other voices, musicians, and how you, the decisions you made with the text. Was the music coming first? Was the text coming first? Was it parallel? You know, mm-hmm. What was guiding you in the musical decisions?
Well, one of the most important ones we did was with Robert Creeley, and it was called Futurities. And I met Bob Creeley in the early 70s, no, in the early 80s, when he came to Paris to do a reading, and Pierre Joris introduced us. And I knew a little bit of Creeley's work before, but when I met him, and we went on the radio together, and I noodled around behind his reading. He read some poems, and I improvised with him. And we hit it off pretty good because he's really into jazz. He knows a lot about jazz, and he loves jazz, and he's a very good reader. And so he read this poem called The Rhythm, and I played with it. And then he left that with me, and I started thinking about that, and I set that to music, The Rhythm. It's a long poem. And then he sent me a book also of some other stuff, and I started to set some of the other things to music. And after, you know, you have to work in the dark for a while. You don't know what you're doing. It's very important to stay in the dark and to keep working even though you don't know what the hell you're doing. So I was setting these various poems of his to music, and after a while I realized that they were all about love. And then it came clear to me that we were going to make a spectacle, a show, a cycle of songs about love, and it turned into like the life of a couple. And then it turned into a jazz wedding. And the idea was to make a jazz wedding, and there were 20 songs of Creeley's in there in a cyclical order from morning till noon to evening, all about the life of a couple and everything that happens to them, including death, children, various betrayal, all kinds of whatever happens, whatever goes down between man and woman. So we made a spectacle, a show out of this called Futurities. And we played that in Europe for quite a few times. We went toured England with it. We played it in France and in Germany and Belgium. And unfortunately, we never brought it to America. And it involves, you know, these things have a life of their own. You start, as I say, working in the dark, but after a while, especially with long practice, it starts to make itself clear. The work tells you what it wants to do. The work tells you where it wants to go, how it should be accompanied, how it should be accomplished. It's not that we tell the work what to do. The work tells us what to do. So this show started to become clear, and then I asked my friend Kenneth Noland, the painter, very famous painter, who's a good friend of ours, I asked him for an altar, because this was going to be a jazz wedding, and we wanted an altar. So he made us this gigantic painting, a chevron triangle with fluorescent paint. And so, and then we had a great lighting man, John Davis, who's a genius at lights. And the painting was such that if the light came from this angle, it would be black. If it came from here, it would be purple. If it came from here, it would be green. The colors kept changing depending on where the light came from. And so in a two-hour spectacle, it was like a magical occurrence, because the altarpiece, the painting, and it's very hot, we still have it in our attic in Paris, kept changing. And then we had a couple. Douglas Dunn was the dancer, and Elsa Wollaston was the other dancer. And I had we had an octet of musicians with harp, and because one of the pieces is heaven, you know, and if you have heaven, you got to have a harp. But if you have a harp, you want a guitar to cool it out, really. So we had harp, guitar, bass, and piano. That was the rhythm section. And then Steve Potts and I, we've been playing together for years, so we had two saxophones, and I added a trombone to it. And there we had, like, you know, three horns, four rhythm, and Irene, two dancers, and lights, and the dancers were, of course, costumed, and the musicians were in the pit. And we played this show, Futurities, for a couple of years, and it lost a lot of money, of course.
Well, yeah, we took it on the road to England.
Took it on the road, yeah.
We were in a big bus. We took it to big Birmingham. Bus.
We had a lot of fun, and a lot of bad critics, and people, you know, it was a struggle to get it done, and then to keep it up. And the main struggle is to play these things often enough so that they become well done. Because the first few times you do these shows, it's too complicated. It's going to be a mediocre performance. It's not well cooked. It's raw. It's crude the first time. You have to have enough gigs, enough jobs, enough opportunities to play these things until they become well done, until they sound good to everyone, until people can really enjoy them. And it's been a struggle to do these things often enough so that they get to the way they should be. Because, as I say, the work has a life of its own, and it's got to be allowed to become itself. And it takes quite a few performances before a work settles down and becomes itself. And I know Anne can tell you the same thing from reading some of her own things. The first time you read something, it's kind of shaky and nervous and all that. If you do the same piece over and over again, after a while you can relax, you can have fun with it, you can get more freedom, and it sounds better and it swings more. And it's the same thing for a small work or a big work. You got to do it a lot of times and allow it to become itself. So that's the story of Futurities. Now, Futurities, the title came about because I was thinking about, well, all these songs, they're about eternal verities. Robert Creeley's texts about love are, you know, it's going to be the same thing in the future and after that. And I thought, and I came up with this word. It's an old-fashioned word, Futurities. It used to be what they called stocks for the future and all that. They don't call it, now they call them futures. But in the old days, when I was young, they called them Futurities, and I thought this was a good title. And I'm very good at titles, that's one of my specialties. And Futurities was the title, and I hope in the future, sometime, to bring this show, which is really an American show, by an American poet, with American painter, American musician, and all that, which we only did in Europe. We never showed it in America because it was too expensive. We tried to get a gig at Brooklyn Academy. We couldn't do it. Nobody wanted it in America. And so it's been asleep since the mid-80s. And that's one of our specialties, is sleepers. We do a lot of sleepers. They sleep for 20 years sometimes. And then they come up. They come up and say, oh, hello.
We're going to do the train. Oh, yeah, just one piece out of that opera.
Yeah, we'll do one piece from that.
It's good for the school. It's about going to school.
What is Yeah, it's called Train Going By. When I was a kid, I wanted to get educated. And to college go to learn how to know. Now old I found, you'd say it.
Now old I found, train going by will take me along, but I still don't know why. Not just for money, not for love, not for anything thought, for nothing I've done. It's gotta be luck keeps the world going round. Myself moving on that train going by.
When I was a kid, I wanted to get educated and to college go to learn how to know. Now old I found, train going by will take me along, but I still don't know why. Not just for money, not for love, not for anything.
And maybe the Nazrin project, maybe speak a little bit about that.
A few years back, around 95, I think, I was reading The New Yorker, and there was a poem by Taslima Nasrin. It was called Happy Marriage. And it was one of the most shocking things I ever read in my life. It made my hair stand on, and I couldn't believe it. It was all about subjugation of women in Bangladesh. And it was a terrifying poem about how I'm married to this man, and he can do anything he wants. He can whip me, beat me, and hang me up by my nails. He can cut my hands off. He can do anything he wants to me. And I wait for him behind the grilled window. And it's just a terrifying poem. I really flipped when I read this.
I'm just laughing because I'm sorry. I'm thinking about Taslima because she laughs a lot too. So you say, if you find a poem like that, you can't really get into that. I mean, you've got to have your distance to make it dramatic. You stylize emotion and you don't become, you know, you don't... identify with this. I mean, I can't explain it. I can't also not sing it to you today, but it was very interesting. It was the most horrendous poem I ever sang in my life.
Well, she asked me to set that to music, and I said, no, I really, it's impossible. This is too, it's too full of brutal imagery. How can you sing that? You know, how can you even sing that? You know, he couldn't, but after a while it started to write itself. these things. You know, when she asks me for something, I say no. And then it starts to come. It starts to come itself, really. And so I set this to music, and then the next year, and we performed it a few times in Chicago for the MacArthur people, and in New York, and in Vancouver as a duo. And it was a very effective piece, very dramatic, and very scary, but very politically informative, and very, So we had this piece, and then we went, we were invited to Berlin for 1 year residence there, the DAAD, which is an organization, a government organization that invites all kinds of artists to Berlin for 1 year. Gives you a salary, an apartment, and you can do anything you want. And we got there, and after a little while, we found ourselves in the same apartment building that Taslima Nasrin was in. She was there for the same program we were. And she was living in the same building we were. And actually, we saw the police coming every hour to comb the building because she's got a price on her head and lives in constant danger of being assassinated. She offended the Muslims and the Hindus, both. And she wrote, she's very bold and a very good poet, and she had a lot of readers. And women were, she was a champion of many women in Bangladesh, and the men, the powers that be, couldn't stand this. And one day she said, the Quran should be revised. And that was the final straw. You're not allowed to say that, really.
But she said that with a cigarette in her hand.
Yeah, with a cigarette in her hand, really.
English television.
On television. Well, they put a fatwa on her and condemned her to death, put a price on her head, and she had to leave Bangladesh. And she went to Sweden, and then she wound up in Berlin in the same building we were. So I said, gee, Taslima, I didn't even know she was going to be in Berlin when we were there. So we had a little gig at a little bar, and I invited her to come and listen.
And she came with all her bodyguards.
She came with the bodyguards, and she listened to us perform the work we call The Cry. It's just that one piece, Happy Marriage. I changed the title to The Cry, because that's what it really is. It's a cry. And she liked it very much, and we started to become friendly. And she, I got a book of hers, poetry. I found it in New York, and I started looking through it. And one day Irene said, let's make an opera. So here we go again. Let's make an opera. It's easy to say, you know. And but actually I started to set some of the things, some of the other poems to music, and they formed themselves and they put themselves in order after a while. And during that year we were in Berlin, we created this opera called The Cry. Even the title was, we went through hell. You know, the original piece was called The Cry, but what to call the opera? I had a page like this of about 150 different titles, and finally we decided on The Cry. And we performed that in Berlin, first of all, and in about 16 other times in the next couple of years, including some disastrous performances here and there in Chicago and Washington and Vancouver, in Finland, in Italy, and some good performances too. And we had a lot of struggle just to get it done because it was really a controversial work. And at first we had Taslima on stage with us and saying the poems in Bengali, and then Irene would sing them in English. But that didn't work out too well because Taslima was not used to jazz, and she was not used to collaborating with other artists on stage. And so we got into an argument, and she quit, and we did it without her for a while. Then she came back and heard it in Washington, and she liked the whole thing, and we became friends again. Now we're very good friends now, and we might do it again with her on stage. Who knows? We're scheduled to play that next summer at the Caramore Festival in New York. I hope it comes off. It's an adventure. These things are an adventure. But anyway, that's a very interesting work. It's mostly women involved. We had an accordion, a harpsichord, two reeds, clarinet and saxophone, and bass and drums, percussion. And we all had costumes made of vests with the words painted on, some of the words from the songs painted on the vest, because one of the subjects of that opera was the danger of words, the danger of speaking out, and the threat of language. And it's a hot potato, really. And actually, one time we performed it, just the three of us, a sketch version of it in Cannes, in the north of France, in Normandy. And well, the police came out, and sirens and dogs and bomb sniffing. And I mean, they really went overboard, really. And it got to be a big drag, really, the political heat. And so, this was a really political work, but also a poetical work.
And because then the musician says, well, we don't want to blow up on stage.
Yeah, really.
Because, but that was one of the dangers when we did it in Berlin. We had to have police everywhere. But there was a sort of perversity into that, too. I mean, people just liked the danger and they pumped it up. And so that's why I got a little bit, had to keep my distance because, political, it was too political for me. I mean, I don't want to blow up on stage either. So now I think it's cool. It's all going to be okay. And things quieten down anyway. Those things are very exploited by the media and by the governments who want to appear left-wing, and they do something for the woman in Bengali, but they do nothing for the woman in their own country. And things like that. You see, I sound bitter. No, it's true. I mean, there's so many problems we have around us, so they like to, project something for far away. I mean, not only about women. I mean, just in general. So that part irritated me a little bit. That was my first experience with this subject, right?
I think so.
I mean,
so,
we do other political things, but they're from the past or people are not around. So this is a very interesting story, but it's going to be beautiful if you do it again.
Yeah, we hope to do it next year and bring it to America, and it's been revised a little bit too.
I was remembering performing with Allen Ginsberg. We were in Toulouse, and do you know Serge Pailly? Serge Pailly, performer, poet, musician, but he was part of the program, and he had been very outspoken in favor of Salman Rushdie and so on. So there had been bomb threats for the performance.
Oh, yeah.
And they made the point of not telling Allen Ginsberg because they thought he would, maybe be more, even more provocative. Oh. But they were plain clothes.
Yeah, that's dangerous. You shouldn't play with those things because, I'm against this playing with the danger like that, It's unnecessary. It just asks for other violence, and so you have to be very careful when you're political in your art. Jack Spicer said that too. I remember that at the time of the Cuban invasion, some people were making political poems, and he was against it, which I thought was very interesting, because a political poem fades out, It's always politics. I mean, just the nature of what we do is like that. So we don't have to put our foot on it, and we shouldn't, I don't know how to explain that, but...
Well, it's a delicate operation.
Down line, yeah, because some people like to make, like Trungpa used to say, there were a lot of poets in the Vietnam War, and they made their living on the situations, of people, and should not do that, right? Didn't he say that? I read that in one of his books, where he said
there was a lot of
Vietnam
aggression.
Poets, and poets, they exploit subjects,
Well, that there was a lot of aggression that actually didn't alleviate the suffering of the people involved, and then was, very egotistical. Well, and so actually Allen came around to that, to seeing a lot of the activity of the 60s, especially in cultural activism, as being counterproductive and, not really achieving what it was setting out to do because of, confusion about Those boundaries are how to even be more skillful.
Yeah. Well, I just don't believe in making the public feeling guilty on putting some heavy trip on them. I think they paid their tickets. They come to enjoy. They have their own load of shit at home or whatever. You know, we have life is hard, and you want to have a little light in all that darkness, as Jack Spicer said. So I'm going to sing to you now this song of Jack Spicer. It's called Advice to Hell, and we call it Agenda. And it's, well, it's just what he says is much better than I, but I learned it from him.
You got it. I don't have it.
It's here. But with the microphone, you shouldn't do it.
I don't need the book. You gonna read the book?
No, you read it in the microphone.
All right.
Yeah, this was part of a series of poems that Jack Spicer did. Oh, incidentally, I never heard of Jack Spicer until Irene turned me on to him. Now I've read most of his stuff and I'm really a big fan. And this one we set a long time ago in 1981. And it's from a series of poems he did called Admonitions. This one was advice to a friend of his. It was called For Hal, but we call it Agenda. So it says, youth is no excuse for such things. Responsibilities weigh like strawberries on a shortcake. Go to the root of the matter. Get laid, have a friend, do anything but be a free fucking agent. No one has lots of them, lays or friends or anything that can make a little light in all that darkness. There is a cigarette you can hold for a minute in your weak mouth and then the light goes out. Rival, honey, friend, and then you stub it out.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So we're going to open it up to some questions. Please feel free to come up to the microphone. Miranda.
I was just wondering if you could talk about your collaboration with Buckminster Fuller.
Well, you know, in Buckminster Fuller was extremely well known back in the 40s and even some of the 30s and the 50s. And when I was coming up in the 50s, he was very well known, really. And I found this book. I'm always, you know, I'm a book freak. I've always been a book freak, and I worked in bookstores, and I used to hang out there and read all kinds of stuff. And one day I found this book, Nine Chains to the Moon, which is his first book. And I was fascinated, by the title. The title, I said, wow, Nine Chains to the Moon. I wonder what that means. I've always been interested in titles. Sometimes I buy a book just from the title or even records. And usually it turns out very interesting. Anyway, Nine Chains to the Moon was a fascinating book and introduced me to the work and thinking of Fuller. And I got more and more interested in him and started getting some other books. And I found this book, No More Secondhand God. And in there was this text from a New Year's card that he sent to all his friends in 1948, and it's called The Historical Press. It's a long title, I can't remember the exact title he used, but it's the text that later, when I met Irene, I set for her to do with the little quintet we had, and the text is so dense and so long that it didn't become a song, it became a litany.
I called it our first rap piece.
It's a rap
piece, really.
Before rap
was even existed.
Yeah.
Because we have to rap down those words because there are too many words and it's very, very long. That's, for example, we give the text to the people because it took me 1 year to understand the text.
It's very rich.
With the dictionary and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And his own language because he had really his own original, like, scientific poetic language. But it was very precise, and it reduced things considerably. That's why he talked like that.
And it's all about the possibilities for sharing the planet's resources and for having good homes for everybody. But it's in almost a Shakespearean language. It's very rich philosophical and scientific language. And so we set that to music, but like a priest intones words on pitch, you mm-hmm. know. So we took each paragraph and gave two notes to each paragraph so Irene could say the words freely using those pitches. Like that. So that's what happened. It is a sort of a rap, but it's also a litany. And we did that in 1967 in Germany. And then it slept. It went to sleep. And we didn't do it again for years.
And now we do it again.
Now we do it. Then we did it with a big band in 89. And now we do it as a duo. And we performed it quite a bit. And we've also been invited to some Buckminster Fuller exhibitions and conferences in England and in the Bauhaus and Dessau, and we perform it for the scientists and for the people that work with Fuller, and they like it very much, and they find it very amusing and interesting.
And we get to know all the scientists.
Yeah, we met a lot of wonderful people that way through
all the smart
doing that work.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have another Buckminster Fuller piece, which we were just doing recently, and it's a sort of a romantic piece of his, more or less to his wife. And what's the name of that? Cosmic Plurality.
Oh yeah, but I don't want to.
But
do that.
She don't want to do that right now.
So you ask some more questions because it's late.
But we have a collection of Bucky's books, and sort of crazy for. I mean, he's one of our main men, really, and we share an interest in his work.
I was very interested in what you said about letting the work tell you mm-hmm. what it is. And yeah. I was wondering if you could speak a little more about the creative process in collaborating. You said that it takes that you both find each other very patient mm-hmm. With each other in collaboration, and that it can also be a struggle. So I was just wondering if you can speak about the collaborative mind. I know Anne probably has things to say about it as well.
Well, I wrote a text once called Saxovision, where it says, "We don't determine music; the music determines us." And I really believe that. Really, that I follow the music. The music doesn't follow me, and the music tells me what to do. And the music has a mind of its own, really, and it always knows more than I do. And I try and stay out of the way.
Yeah, but sometimes when you say that in schools, they'll get a little bit nervous because, I mean, it invites people to be lazy.
Uh-huh.
And I think it just comes to
no,
me.
No, it's not about being lazy.
Inspiration it's, or something like that. I think you have to work very hard.
You have to work very hard, and you have to work in the opposite way long enough so that the process starts to unfold by itself, because it doesn't at first. At first, you have to bang your head against the wall and really, work very hard to find the first few pieces that I wrote. I didn't know what I was doing, and I really struggled for years to find just the basic pitches involved. And later on, it got easier. But at first, it's a long, long process. By now, I let the work go its own way because it knows me. I know it. But at first, it's not like that. And a friend of mine told me a good anecdote, Richard Teitelbaum. He studied with a very good teacher. I think it was Andre Previn. He studied composition with him years and years ago. And one of the assignments was to make a little piece. He said, okay, make a little piece. Write this piece for next week. And Richard asked him, well, how do I find the notes for this piece? And the professor said, bang your head against the piano.
That's cruel.
It's interesting sometimes how, some little seed or rune, especially when you're working with others who, say, find something in your work or your poem. And I was involved with a recent collaboration where the visual artist Richard Tuttle had heard me read some years ago a poem called Make Up on Empty Space, and that title stuck in his head, and he started thinking visually about making a box that would also be a book, that would be a performance, that would be a lantern. Suddenly this, very three-dimensional thing that then had a very extended vision in his mind. And so I was invited with that text, although then I started writing another text. We all went up to the printer's home in upstate New York, and there was Richard had designed, he wanted also to work with this wonderful Chinese opera man, Su Chen, and Richard had designed these makeup, sort of taking off from Chinese makeup. Su Chen was a Chinese opera director, the traditional Chinese opera, who was also a singer and performer himself. Then Mr. Caldaway, who was the printer and publisher, had invited, his wife is actually a Chinese woman who's plays various instruments, but is also a composer. So she was invited into the mix. And then we had Chinese opera makeup person there doing the makeup. Then we had a film crew and a taping and photography. And then I was invited to be writing on the spot. And so we all lived together for a weekend and started this, amazing collaboration. And then I started taking on a role as director, like directing Su Chen, who was being filmed, and putting him in the pond and putting him on a rock and having him at one point in a tree hanging upside down and singing these ancient Chinese shaman songs. And somehow the whole thing was recorded, and then writing came out of that. I'd kept a journal. And then we, we communicated, we separated and then had all this working material. And then Richard went into the workshop with the printer and then designed
you know, something that did become all these things, the book, the lantern, the tape, the videotape, the song. So that was very, I think, a very unusual collaboration, but it started for him with this title of a poem. So that was one way. And then, you know, I was curious, what draws you? I know you have, there's a kind of passion in the material you are drawn to, a certain kind of investigation of, you know, origins and cosmic things that seem to have an ageless quality or move over time, but without being, just message.
We are ageless.
Uh-huh. Good.
Well, it's first of all, you got to fall in love with the text in order to deal with it in the first place, because you have to spend so much time with it that you don't want to deal with something that doesn't turn you on. And also for Irene, she's got to spend so much time with it to learn how to deal with it, that also it's got to be something that she's interested in also. So the text has got to turn you on, and that's very important. And then the consideration also is that it's got to be worth singing about, worth communicating, and also music is a possibility that music can make certain texts better known than they are. And that's been a very strong motive in the choice of what we did a lot. For example, Taslima Nasrin, I thought those things should be better known. And even the song we did about race, when I read that in the paper, I said, wow, that's very interesting. Everybody should hear that. Everybody should know that. So that's a factor, I think.
Hello, Irene. Here? I'm very interested in hearing you speak about, and quite specifically, if you don't mind, on the decisions you make as a creative collaborator, with how you place your voice or what you do with your voice relative to, let's say, a specific line of text and some of the thinking behind those decisions. For instance, whether to reinforce what Steve Lacy is doing or to diverge from it and why. I was hoping you would speak fairly specifically by giving us one or two examples, reconstructing, if you will, the creative process, however briefly.
I do both. I do, well, Steve writes music. His music is very, technically, it's very precise. His rhythms are very precise. It's 5-7. You have to really know music to read his partitions. And I guess because I've learned music when I was young, and I can play the piano and the violin and the cello, so that's not a problem for me. So the other thing is about vocal technique. That took me years. That took me that's my major thing. It's to have a good technique, a vocal technique, so not to waste my voice shouting, pushing, made it flow, and sometimes, I mean, that's very important, so I can sing forever. And then when I take a song, like just the last song is from Anne, In the Pocket, we're going to sing that, I think, tomorrow. And, I can't explain it. I look at the music, I analyze the music, I see the... they're so well written. I must give a big compliment to Steve that the words are so well served with the music that I don't have to do much. And I don't like to be too much emotion in... I don't have to put any emotion in what I do. I mean, it's just... I just have fun. But I don't have to... He writes it so good, you know. You move the moon in a mellow tone. And then da-da-da-da, you know, and I place around with these lovely words Anne wrote, you know.
And with Andrew. It was a collaboration with Andrew originally as a Christmas card, solstice card.
And so it's really easy for me now. Now, I don't know if he steals sometimes my feelings or my ideas. That doesn't really matter because... because he knows what, you know, he knows I have a lot of fun and fantasy and tragic things. And so, you know, it's, but in singing, it's really, as my teacher said, we're not going to work on emotion because you have too much emotion, she says. I have this old teacher, she says. We work on stylized emotion, and that's what I like. I don't like to get all over the place, which I, you know, I can feel it when I do it sometimes. I like to be in control and give and have not too many moods. In one song there is this mood, in the other song is this mood. People don't want to hear too many moods. It's tiring. It's tiring, you know, to give you too many moods. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm.
One last comment. We could probably have a little break before the colloquium, our final roundup where all the faculty come and give shots. So one last question.
Well, I think basically I was more curious about what you folks do when you are in disagreement.
Oh.
How does one solve this problem? I mean, do we go to our corners and come out day later, or?
Oh, no.
that would be artistic, we don't disagree about, we've never had I can't think of any disagreement about whether to do something or not. I mean, really, I wouldn't even deal with it if I didn't think that she would, it's something that she could sing, really. And in general, she approves of the text before I start it. And very often she asks for, well, please, can you set this to music for me? You know, and she asks me, and I do it if I can. And so there isn't too much disagreement about that. We do disagree about the menu sometimes, you know, what to sing, when, but not how. But, you know, because we have a big choice of things, and I'm ambitious and greedy and hungry, and I want to hear my things, of course, so sometimes I push her too hard, really, and she says, no, wait, don't push me, you know, get off my back. You know? And so she turns me off when I get carried away, and when she gets carried away, she knows it herself. I don't have to say anything, really. But we all get carried away.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Stephen Irene.
It's a very good.